and welcome to episode 39 of season 11 of Movie Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me is Richard Kirkham of Kirkham Movie a Day and the Shepherd of the Lamb. Welcome back to the show for yet another season, Richard.
Thank you, Rob. It's always great to do these movie by the minute. I know we're not sticking strictly to the minute here, but I'm having a good time, so it'll be fine.
Yeah, well, if we were stick to the minute, we'd be here for 2.5 years. So a little bit of an inconvenience to do it for so long. So
it all works.
Both for the host and guests and listeners. So I figured I would truncate it a little bit, like I did with my diehard duo last summer. So why not? If it works, it's not my favorite way of doing it, but when the need arises, it's good to have a backup plan.
It's your show; you get to do what you want on it. That's the way I look at it.
Okay, that's true. Also, and that makes sense. But what can you do? All right, so let's begin with what is your background with Band of Brothers?
This is, as I think I've heard a couple of times from your previous guests, the first time I've watched the series. I've known about it for 20 years, and I expected to watch it years ago. When it was first on, it was on HBO, and I didn't subscribe to that cable channel in those days, and so I never watched it when it was on, and I thought about buying it on a DVD or Blu-ray at the time. I guess it would have been DVD at the time when it came out, but I never did. Shame on me. But I figured eventually I would catch up with it, and when your show came along, it gave me the opportunity to finally require myself to do something that I've always wanted to do, just haven't gotten around to doing. So kickstarted it, so to speak.
Okay, that makes sense. I had a friend in high school that had in his locker, on like the inside part of his locker, a round like a circle like that was cut out, and it said on it TUIT, and he says I always have with me a round to it.
I gotcha.
Yeah, but that worked for him.
We used to it was a novelty item that you got at the magic shops. They had a wooden coin and it said TUIT on it, and you tossed the coin to somebody and said, here, you'll get around to it.
Okay, that makes sense too.
Yeah,
so it's a multi-generational
yeah, no, that joke's existed for a long time.
yes, for sure. All right, I'm very glad that I was able to finally help you take this off your bucket list to be able watch at least half of it so far.
I still have the second half to get through, but okay. It's all going well.
You have time, we won't get into the later episodes for a few months. So you have a little good bit of time if you want to really pay attention to what's going on and keep catching on with this. So that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. Episode 39 begins with Winters letting everyone in on a little bit of a secret and ends with Garnier stopping Babe in his tracks. So we ended things yesterday. We dealt with the whole Blythe aspect of it, including Blythe getting shot, and Winters just trying to figure out what the officers are trying to figure out what to do, and Winters comes up and tells them that they're being moved, and he says to a field camp north of Utah Beach, and he goes, hot food and showers, and back to England. So the officers are quite happy about this. They're ready for a change, finally leaving Holland. But what's funny is at the exact same time, Welsh is listening, but he's still lighting up a cigarette. he decided to take the time to take a little break with the cigarette, and the cigarette doesn't light up, and he just throws it on the ground. And it's quite funny because he looks very frustrated, but he's just been given relatively good news that they're being taken off the front line and stuff like that. But You know, he's just frustrated by the cigarette. So,
the lighter was just not cooperating with him. And of course, they had wet weather.
Yes, true. That's true. And then the shot changes, and we are at some sort of medical aid station or something like that. And we see a whole bunch of Jeeps and trucks around, you know, a lot of them with the Red Cross on them. We see injured soldiers walking around. We see a lot of drums of gas, of gasoline. And, you know, there's also a smaller gasoline, I don't even know what containers, basically, that you can put on some sort of vehicle and stuff like that. Now,
jerry cans, they're called.
That's right. That's the word, jerry can. Did you notice that there's a sign in the back in red?
And I did see a sign, but I didn't pay attention to it.
Okay, yeah, we can't read all of it, but what we can read is pretty interesting because it says slow. You're entering Purple Heart Avenue.
Oh, wow.
Speed limit 15 miles per hour. Do not something. So I just thought it was really funny that it's called Purple Heart Avenue because, you know, obviously, as we know, someone gets a Purple Heart for being injured. But
it's a reminder that everybody there is wounded. And you got to be careful about people who are maybe having trouble getting around, and you got to slow down and be careful, but also respectful of the folks who have been injured in the process of fighting this war.
That is correct. And when one does a search for what is Purple Heart Avenue, so it is most famously referring to the Purple Heart Lane, which is Route N13 near Carentan, France, obviously. A deadly D-Day causeway where U.S. paratroopers suffered heavy casualties, earning the nickname. It also refers to a song by Cairo Ye, and a section of the National Purple Heart Trail is dedicated to honoring wounded veterans across the U.S. So, you know, they're because of all the fighting here and the huge losses and injuries and casualties and stuff like that, they, you know, the fact that they renamed this area, you know, Purple Heart Avenue or Purple Heart Lane is pretty interesting. There's now a memorial there that honors the sacrifice with a whole bunch of signs all around, obviously marking the route.
Well, I think
I thought this was just interesting that you know, the detail that they're able to have that sign
there. It is interesting, and I like the fact that they were, you know, there's a lot of it's more authentic as a result. Verisimilitude, that's the word I was looking for. Purple Heart Trail, I think, in the U.S., runs through this area that I live in. I think I've seen signs indicating it, but I've never investigated it to see exactly what it entails. I assume that it's got something to do with, you know, the military transportation that was used in the U.S. during the war, but I don't know. Have you ever looked it up? Well,
I of course I have. Of course I have. So the Purple Heart Trail is a national system of designated roads, highways, bridges, and monuments honoring recipients of the Purple Heart Medal for wounds or death in combat. Established in 1992 by the Military Order of the Purple Heart to provide a symbolic tribute to their sacrifices, with signs varying by state, but universally reminding travelers that freedom comes at a cost.
Okay.
And it starts in Mount Vernon, Virginia. And the trail connects numerous designated sections across 45 states and even in Guam, which I guess you need to find a way to jump, you know, from the U.S.
That's, over to Guam. That's a long ferry, right?
That's right. And it follows some of the major interstates like I-35, I-40, I-70 along the way. So, that's, yeah, you know, I don't know if that's what's near you.
Well, I-35, I-70 would both be near me.
Okay, I-35 is in Texas. Yeah. Okay, here it is. And so is I-40.
Yeah.
I-35 is in Texas and Kansas. I-40 is in Arizona, Arkansas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Texas. And I-70 is in Colorado, Kansas. MO is Missouri? I think MO. Right, MO
yes,
is Missouri.
That's Missouri. Yes, right. Yes.
Okay. That's what I thought, because it's next to Kansas, obviously, so it makes sense. They would have that there. But yeah, now when I did a search, I actually found a picture of the actual sign,
Oh,
and I can
nice.
actually read. I can now read what I couldn't read before. Okay, so it says, "Slow, you are now entering Purple Heart Avenue. Speed limit 15 miles per hour. Do not race your motor." That's the do not, and I never would have guessed that that was the do not at the bottom. That's not something that I would have expected it to say.
It's, probably like a quiet zone for the wounded when they're being
Yeah, probably.
recovered. Don't make excessive noise. It's like, don't use your engine brakes in neighborhoods for the trucks when they give them instructions.
Right.
So
Makes sense.
cut down on the noise. That makes sense.
But again, it's very cool that the attention to detail here is unbelievable. There's no question about that. And the fact that they're talking about Carrington, and we know that they're in Carrington right now, or they're outside of Carrington, and they have this sign there, means someone really did they did their research
Yeah.
about this whole thing. So I just love it. And after that happens, we see a Jeep show up, and then the camera pans, and we see another Jeep with someone wounded on it, and then we see other soldiers walking around, some with bloody uniforms, I guess reminding us of MASH and stuff like that. And then we see a whole pile of uniforms, and they show us the uniform with of Blythe that has
Edelweiss flower.
the Edelweiss flower on it,
Yeah.
which again, as I mentioned the other day, Edelweiss is not mentioned anywhere in the book. So this was all creative license for them to add it here. And then the shot changes, and we're back in Carrington itself, and we see Welsh resting basically, and Winters then walks by him and goes, "Harry." And Harry looks at him and goes, "How's the leg?" And he goes, "Stiff, sore. They want me to take it easy for a few days." He goes, "Yeah, you should." And he goes, "I talked to Colonel Tink. Said he appreciated easy holding the line." Said General Taylor was pleased. He goes, "Yeah. Well, that's why I came to France, to please General Taylor." And the two of them start laughing, and he goes, "Yeah." So it's again, this is downtime.
And
This is
the lower ranks kind of mocking in a not too derogatory way the high command. I came to France to please General Taylor, of course. There's a little
that's right.
sarcastic comment between compatriots here about the higher ups.
Now, did you notice that there's two guys in the back that are like, one of them has like a brown paper bag that he's pulling stuff out of and then throwing it to the other guy? Maybe it's like I don't know, cigarettes, or perhaps an apple or something. It's I mean, it's in the background, so you can't really tell exactly what he's throwing, but it's just funny that while the two of them are talking, you can see that in the background.
Well, there's activity in the background. That's one of the things that gives the authenticity to the events because, you're not just focusing on the two guys sitting there. There's the rest of the company doing whatever they're doing, passing the time as well.
Exactly. Exactly. Again, it makes sense. The way that they do that. And then the shot changes, and we are now next to a hospital, and it says the 91st General Hospital, which I guess we've moved up from Purple Heart Lane to the 91st General Hospital.
I got the impression that this was back in England.
I believe it is, yes.
Because the buildings are a lot more established. It looks like it's a permanent location as opposed, it's not a MASH unit for sure.
Right. It was a hospital that was stationed near Churchill Hospital in Oxford, England.
Okay.
So yeah. they're already back in England, and then we're inside of the ward itself, and we see someone getting someone making a little speech, and he goes, "In grateful acknowledgement of the blood shed in the service of your country, it is an honor to present you with the Order of the Purple Heart." Everyone cheers around them, as Smokey Gordon is getting the medal. And he goes, "Thank you, sir." And then, the procession moves away, and then he looks to the guy next to him, which is Popeye. And Popeye goes, "How many does that make?" And he goes, "Two." He goes, "Three." He goes, "You have no shame." He goes, "Well, I got one hole in my shoulder, a second in my calf. Then there's the boil on my shin that had to be lanced." And then he looks over at Blythe and goes, "And he's only got one." And, they do a great job of zooming in on Blythe's eyes right now, where he's just staring out in, I would say staring out into space, but it's staring out, and we get to see, once again, the sky, the clouds in the sky.
Yeah, kind like of that perspective when we first met him, when he was standing there in the field, exactly. Staring up, and all the other soldiers finally encounter him, and he's not exactly zoned out, but he is definitely, looking into the atmosphere, and he's in a different place, and we get that same perspective here as a transition.
Exactly. And we then see that Smokey puts the third Purple Heart under his pillow.
Yeah.
You'd think they would be keeping track of these type of things in the ward, especially given what we're going to talk about shortly, about what he does with one of these.
Yeah.
It's just very strange that there's no record of the fact that they'd already given him two, so that type of thing.
Well, I don't know how they designated those things. I would assume that people who ended up in one of those hospitals, by default, unless they fell down and broke their arm by accident, and that's why I think having a boil lance isn't really going to get you a Purple Heart.
Correct. Yeah, I mean the book does talk about this actual story. Of him, not wanting to go off the line, but since he needed to get the boil taken care of. So, I mean, the shot that they get to show us of Blythe theoretically looking up in the sky is a beautiful shot, the way that they show it to us, because, it has a whole bunch of colors, like they're rainbow colors, I guess, reflecting from something. So I like the way they do that.
No, it looks nice.
And then, the shot changes, and we see two characters riding in a motorcycle with a sidecar, and just going through the countryside. And then, when we get to see who they are, we see that it's Moore and Malarkey, and Malarkey's got a beer, and these guys are having a fun time. And he goes, "Woohoo!" And they laugh. This is great. Yay! Showing these guys know how to let off some steam, I guess, when they're back in England, trying to figure out how to deal with all this stuff here.
I was a little nervous about watching that scene because it reminded me so much of the opening of Lawrence of Arabia, where we discover how Lawrence died.
Right. Exactly. They do some interesting maneuvers along the way also. Then Malarkey goes, "She fancied me, Alton. She fancied me, Alton." And they come across a truck that's coming in their way, and which honks at them, and they go, "Jesus Christ!" And they swerve out of the way to try to get around that. But and the music here is also great with what the music throughout the whole series is great.
Yeah.
But this particular scene is also the music really adds so much to what's going on here. And they scream again, "Woohoo!" And it goes, "It's good to be alive." And Malarkey then, he salutes him with the beer, basically, by lifting up toasting the driver with the beer, I guess you can say. And he goes, "Woo!" And he goes, "Jesus Christ, that was close." He goes, "Nah, missed him by a mile." So, Now, the story about this particular motorcycle is very interesting because it and I'm surprised they didn't give us a little bit more information about it in the miniseries about how they acquired this motorcycle. But in the book, on page 82, it mentions it, and it says Private Moore pulled one last raid on the vast supply dump. He broke into the main motor pool and stole a motorcycle complete with sidecar. He hid it behind a sand dune, then asked Captain Winters if he can put it on the LST and take it back to England. Up to you, Winters replied. The next day, as the company marched up the ramp of the gigantic LST, Moore moved the motorcycle up the inland side of the forward dune. He had arranged with Malarkey for a hand signal when everybody was aboard and it was time to go. Malarkey tipped off the Navy personnel. At the proper moment, standing on the ramp, Malarkey gave the signal, and Moore came roaring over the dune and up the ramp. On the LST, the skipper said to Welsh, "Lieutenant, what would you like to have? Chicken or steak? Ice cream, eggs?" Sailing in convoy, the LST got back to Southampton the night of July 12th. The next morning, a train took the men, except Moore and Malarkey, who rode their motorcycle to Aldbourne. "It was wonderful to be back," Winters remembered. "Everybody was glad to see us. It was just like home." So again, it's a nice way that they add this whole thing. And then they continue talking about the motorcycle, and they say, on weekends, when they were not in the marshalling area or on alert, the men got passes. Malarkey and Moore would jump on their motorcycle and head for the south coast, Brighton, Bournemouth, or Southampton. A shout out to Jay, who lives in Bournemouth.
Bournemouth, yes.
So maybe there's something there, Jay. Maybe there's some remnant of Malarkey and Moore coming to Bournemouth for swimming and sunbathing. Upon returning from one such excursion, they got a message from Captain Sobel. So I'm jumping a little bit ahead because we're going to talk about this next week. And it says he wanted Malarkey and Moore to know that he knew they had a motorcycle and that it was stolen. But he was not going to do anything about it except that he intended to confiscate it when the company next went into combat. Malarkey figured that Sobel's relatively reasonable attitude was a result of his unwillingness to confront Winters. So again, it's interesting that this is a stolen motorcycle, and we see these guys taking a joyride, but there's really no indication that this is stolen. I mean, again, next week we will talk about that, but right now there's no hint at all that this is a stolen vehicle. This is just guys letting off steam. So it's pretty interesting that they didn't go into a little bit of detail just to mention that fact. Maybe they wanted Malarkey and Moore to look a little better, by not having everyone know that they actually stole this motorcycle. But then again, it reminds me of MASH,
I think it's much more likely that they just are editing events for time, because you can't get everything in, and you got to make it clear enough that they are doing something that is outside of the norm, but you don't necessarily have to provide all the details about how they acquired the motorcycle. And we get hints later on that it was misappropriated.
Exactly. No, of course we're going to get into that. But again, I like the way that they present these guys basically blowing off the steam. So it's great. I think it's done really well. And they end up showing up with the I guess at the barracks of where everyone's staying. And a bunch of guys see them and just start chatting with them a little bit as they get out. And then we're now back in a I guess a makeshift mess hall, and we see all the men are there. Gordon is actually standing there, and we have getting ready. Gordon wants to say something, and then Cobb is sitting with Luz and with Martin, and Cobb tells everyone, "Hey, shh, Uber." He goes, "What? Be quiet for the man." And then Gordon starts telling a little bit of a poem. We see that he has the three purple hearts stuck on his chest, and he goes, "The night of the bayonet, the night was filled with dark and cold when Sergeant Talbert And everyone starts laughing, and Pepper goes, "I don't like this." The story's told. Pulled on his poncho and headed out to check the lines, dressed like a kraut. Everyone starts laughing again. And Lucky goes, "Why is everyone in such a hurry to get back, huh? Hospital's food doesn't suit you?" Says, "We don't need you anymore, Tab." And then, we see that in the background that Winters and Nixon are whispering to one another as Gordon continues, and he goes, "Upon a trooper, our hero came fast asleep. He called his name. Oh, Smith, get up. It's time to take your turn out on the line." And then Hashi turns to, you have the new recruits that are talking, which we haven't really been introduced to yet. But Hashi then says to the guy the next to him, he goes, "You guys have any idea what this is about?" And then Garcia responds, "The Knight of the Bayonet, whatever that is." And, then in the back, we still see Nixon now walks over to Compton and starts whispering to him something. And then Gordon continues and goes, "But Private Smith, though very weary, cracked an eye all red and bleary, grabbed his rifle. He did not tarry, hearing Floyd, but seeing Cherry." And, we see that Smith is a little bit embarrassed and laughing about this whole thing. And he goes, "Oh, God." And then someone screams out, "Way to go, Smithy." And then Gordon continues with his speech, and he goes, "It's me," cried Tab, "don't do it." And yet Smith charged, toot sweet with bayonet. He lunged, he thrust both high and low, and skewered the boy from Kokomo. And everyone just starts clapping, and they really like this whole thing. And as this is being told, we still have the guys in the background talking, whispering to one another, not 100% sure what they're dealing with, but it is the all of the officers. And then Nixon whispers something to Lip, and again we're still not sure what he's saying. But I mean, first of all, this is a great scene showing the camaraderie of these characters.
It is good, and they know a little bit about each other. I'm going to mention Kokomo, Indiana, as
That's right.
that's my mother's family's hometown. And her cousin, who who was the actor Strother Martin, was also from
Oh, yeah, of
Kokomo.
course. Oh, wow. That's interesting. So it makes me wonder if he knew Talbert.
They might have known each other, it would be one of those things that would not be that far a coincidence because he was in that era.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why I'm mentioning it, because also, I mean, I'm sure you noticed that in the very first episode, Talbert got got a package, and it had a gun. That the chief of police of Kokomo sent him a gun, to go shoot at. So for you, when you probably watched it, it probably jumped out at you. They're saying, "Hey, Kokomo,
Yep.
I know people from Kokomo."
That's it.
Very interesting. And then we see that Babe pretty much has had enough and gets up to start leaving, and he says to the guys around him, he goes, "I'm heading back to the barracks." And then he gets stopped by Garnier. And Garnier goes, "You Heffron?" And he goes, "Yeah." And Garnier doesn't let him go further. And that's how this particular 5-minute segment ends. So people are gonna have to come back tomorrow to find out what Garnier wants from Heffron. Is there anything else that you wanted to add, Richard?
Just a side note, the caps that they're wearing when the motorcycle arrives at the base and they get off and they put their own caps on, with the insignia on it, that was before there was an Air Force, and that insignia is the Army Air Force. Basically, and I know this because I had one of those caps that belonged to my father, and I wore it quite a bit when I was a little boy.
Oh, wow. Did your father serve in World War II?
Yeah, he was in the 11th Airborne, which was stationed originally in Alaska, but when he got there, they moved them to the South Pacific, and he fought in the Philippines and was part of the occupying forces in Japan.
Oh, wow. Very nice.
But I recognize that insignia immediately.
Do you still have it?
I think I do. I think it's, but it's in a box in the shed back in my house in California. If I had to dig it out, it would take me a week.
Okay, so we won't trouble you to try and
If
get
I
it from
had
your
it,
home.
I would hold it up and or take a picture and send it to
That's okay.
you.
I believe you. All right, excellent. So today's segment is Banned Brand, where my guests will give their top five fictional movie bands. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Well, my number five is the largest band in the list. It's made up of a half dozen plus singers, and then you've got a variety of sidemen, and they're all Irish youth from Dublin, The Commitments,
Very nice.
which is a terrific film. If anybody hasn't seen it, I think it's Alan Parker. I'm trying to remember. I think that's correct. And
I believe so.
it's a band that didn't last long, but they were a soul band from Dublin, and the performances are quite spirited in that movie.
Yes. Okay.
Number four is Sing Street. The band by the young men in the school there in it's Ireland, I believe, that they're located. And they and the school is a lot stricter than we would be used to, and their mere presence as a band is kind of rebellious. And it's set in the 80s, and they have a it's a perfect rendition of 80s vibe when it comes to creating music. And
Yes,
the riddle of the
very
model is a
German.
blast. That's one of the songs that they do. And number three, Josie and the Pussycats. I like all of the songs in Josie and the Pussycats. I could listen to those
You
on
talking about the movie, or you're talking about the animated
the
show
movie.
from the 70s?
The movie. I
Okay.
don't remember the animated show very well. I knew it existed, and I knew that the movie was based on that. But the movie is much more sophisticated than the TV comedy animation show was, and the songs were really well written and very tuneful, and I listen to them on a pretty regular basis. It's great. Number two would be Strange Fruit from Still Crazy, which is a 70s band that's looking to make a comeback. And the music was created by two of the guys from Foreigner, and there's a great ballad in the movie, "The Flame Still Burns," and it's always worth listening to. And I like the story in that film quite well, and the characters are great. And Bill Nighy is in the band also, so there's enough to laugh at there. And then my top band, of course, is Spinal Tap, who was good enough to have two movies about them.
I haven't had a chance to see the second one yet.
It's not obviously not as great as the first because it doesn't have the spontaneity and surprise that the first one had, but I think it's quite entertaining. I think it's very legitimate as a follow-up. I would have liked more original music in the second one. Mostly we get callbacks to the first set of music that we had from the original film, but the guys are just as amusing and arcane and wacky as they were in the first film, even though they're 45 years older.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. All right. Excellent. Thank you very much for that list.
No
So now
problem.
we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie. So I will randomly spin the wheel and let's see what movie you're gonna get that I'm gonna give you some hints and you have to try and guess what movie it is. And round and round and around the wheel goes. Okay, this is an interesting one. Okay, this is a movie from 1951, starring James Mason and Cedric Hardwicke, and it's all about a famous German general.
All right, it's Rommel, and I'm trying to remember if what the James Mason film is. Is it Raid on Rommel? I'm sure there's another one that
What was Rommel's nickname?
the Desert Fox.
Exactly.
Is that the name of the film?
Yes.
Ex
It's the name of
excellent,
the movie.
excellent.
And what's really interesting, and I didn't know about this before, is that Jessica Tandy is in it.
Huh, interesting. Was Hume
Yeah.
Cronyn in the film also? I was wondering if they were still working together that long, you know. I don't remember when they
No.
got together. Okay.
He wasn't in this movie. I mean, Hume Cronyn, I've seen in movies from the
Oh yeah.
40s. Quite famously, he was in Lifeboat, which is one of my favorite movies, Hitchcock movie. They got married in 1942, so they were married at the
Yeah.
time.
I knew they were together for a long time, and I thought that they might work together somewhat regularly. I don't know. You know, I know that they did in their later years, and I just took a shot at it.
Okay, and no, it's a very legitimate and good question. Right. So, Richard, would you like to tell people where they can find Richard Kirkham?
Well, my personal site is Kirkham a Movie a Day. I have a blog site at blogspot.com. So if you search Kirkham Class at blogspot.com, you'll find it there. But if you want the easy way to do it, you can also just search Kirkham a Movie a Day, and that'll take you to the WordPress site, which is basically a doppelganger of the main content. They don't have all of the same content, but on the main content, it's all exactly the same. And then every week, you can locate me on the Lamcast, where I am the host of the Lamcast, which is the official podcast of the large association of movie blogs. It's a weekly podcast, and we have guests on a regular basis. We have a rotating crew of bloggers, podcasters, and longtime fans of movies who take t their time out every week to join us and talk about a variety of subjects. We do new movies occasionally. We do lots of look-back shows. We do draft shows. And Movie Rob's been a guest on many of those occasions. So we're always happy to have people come and visit us on the Lamcast.
Always fun. Always fun joining the conversations at the Lamb. No question about that. All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So until tomorrow, great.
Curly.